dependence. One thing depending on another. One thing depends on another. It's called relative. That's one of the definitions Prabhupada gives somewhere in this purport. One thing, relative truth or dependent truth. One of the words that describes the absolute truth in this text is swarat. He's fully independent. Doesn't depend upon anything, either for his existence or any powers or anything else he may have. The question comes up that we see that things are dependent. We start here in the material world and we see that we are dependent. Another expression that we use for the sense of being dependent is conditioned. Our existence is conditioned by other things. That means we live or thrive only under certain conditions, that we get so much air, light, food, water. Those things are given to us in regular supplies. So we're conditioned or we're dependent for our existence on some arrangement. Therefore, we are not absolute. We're relative. So then you ask, where do we get our supplies from? Where does it all come from for us? So you go to a source. Vedic knowledge is that they're warehouses. Devatas who run these warehouses where the storehouse of air, water, the supplying agents that you get this from. They're going to this devata for that, that devata for this, this devata for that, this devata for that. The gods, the vibhudimat sattvas, the Prabhupada says. Then the question, where do they get their supplies from? So at this point, you have an alternative that we talked about yesterday at the end. You can say, well, they get it from another person. Where does that person get its supplies, or that agent, where does it get its supplies from? And you keep pushing it back. And either you keep going back and back and back and back and back. This is the regress, infinite regress. Or else you come to something that's categorically different. An absolute truth, an absolute, not a relative, something that's unconditioned, which supplies everything, but doesn't get its supplies from anywhere else, and is not diminished. As soon as it's diminished, then that absolute would need resupplied, and therefore would be dependent. So this is the notion that's contained. The text, which quoted often by Prabhupada, this is in the Katha Upanishad and the Svetashvatara Upanishad. So this is what we call a Shruti mantra, a mantra from the Upanishads. This describes the absolute truth, and it describes it in theistic terms. Here you have, in the first line, you have this word nitya. We know what nitya means. It means eternal, or ever-existing, always, perpetual. Nitya, eternal. This is singular. This is plural. This is nominative singular, and this is genitive plural. Nitya, nityanam. Which is very terse. Among many nityas, there is one particular nitya. Among many chetanas, chetanam, there is one particular chetana. Chetana means conscious. This is talking about eternal conscious entities, not talking about living entities in Maya. It's talking about as they are. So it's saying, what it's saying is that there are two categories or classes of eternal conscious beings. One category or class is singular, nityaha, chetana. And the other category is multiple, nityanam, chetananam. In this class, this is a set that only has one member. This nitya. That is the category of the absolute truth, or God. One, remember that? Ekam eva advitiyam. One without a second. There it is. Singular. No, nobody else in his class. Everyone else belongs to another class, which is plural. And here it explains Eko, the one. Ekaha. Eka, bahunam, the many. Yo vididatta kaman. He is supplying, the one is supplying all the desires or the necessities for the many. That's the difference. In other words, the one is independent and the many are dependent. Who is supplying all the necessities for the one? Nobody. Huh? A different class of being. His kind of existence is different from the existence of dependent beings.
Aside from the fact that it's actually true that this is how thing is, how things are, and the Shastras say it, mm-hmm. the Sadhus say it, just on the basis of logic, is there any reason why this is more logical?
Yeah, we'll get that's the next step. First I want to get the idea out. And then we'll look at it and see if there's any way we can deal with it by logic. This is going to, that's going to be called philosophical speculation. Which differs from mental speculation. The difference is that philosophical speculation ends in Krishna, whereas mental speculation is all over the map. But we can only engage in philosophical speculation if we know where we're going. Yes?
I was wondering if does it refer to Vishnu Tattva or specifically to Krishna?
Vishnu Tattva. Vishnu Tattva is one. There's only one God. When we speak of Vishnu Tattvas, we may speak of different forms, but they are one. They are not many. Vishnu, the Lord, may be revealed to us in different aspects because of different relationships, but He's one. One person. One entity. Not many like this. So this refers to the absolute truth, nityaha, singular. So when you say we are getting our supplies, everything's getting supplies, you come to one who is just giving and supplying everybody and doesn't receive any supplies in exchange. His existence is different, categorically different. And that's described in the invocation to Ishopanishad. Om Purnam Ada Purnam Idam Purnat Purnam Udachate Purnasya Purnam Adaya Purnam Eva Vashishate. This is also a description of the Absolute Truth, who is given this word Purna, which means full or complete or perfect. Purna. The Absolute Truth is perfect and complete. And what also emanates from Him is also Purna. Perfectly equipped as complete wholes. And it says that He's so complete that even if you took Purna out of Purna, He would still be Purna. In other words, if Krishna is like, He's emanating, everything's coming out, supplies are going, and He's never diminished. Not one bit diminished. All energy comes from Him, He's not diminished. If you have a pizza pie, you give away slices, the pie becomes less. Here is a pie, the absolute pizza. The pizzas in the spiritual world, you just give out, and they remain full and complete. That's the nature of the absolute truth. And if you also could add to Him, He also doesn't increase. As Prabhupada says, 1 minus 1 equals 1, 1 plus 1 equals 1. That's a different kind of nature. Now let's just look at this in terms of existence. Now, by the way, and we're talking about dependency, and we think of this in terms of causality. Not necessarily do you have to think of it as a temporal chain of dependence. You know, sometimes you think one thing causes another, you're going back in time. But just think of it as, a machine that gets its power from another machine, which gets its power from, they're all plugged in, you know. And ultimately they're plugged into one machine. The juice is flowing simultaneously. And there's one machine that is like a generator. It's generating all power. All the other machines are going. And it itself is just like a, you know, it's not getting anything from anywhere else. But yet it just generates and generates and generates. Huh? Now think of it in terms of also existence. His existence doesn't depend. See, on the relative level, your existence depends upon that. Our existence is borrowed existence. His existence is the absolute truth, is he doesn't depend upon anything for his existence. Self-sufficient. He's described this way in the Upanishads as self-sufficient, independent existence. So we're with contingent beings or dependent beings. You can exist or you can't exist. Depends. Things bring you into certain conditions, you exist. And then you can go out of existence when those things go away. But here's something that never came into being and will never go out of being. No matter what. That's just the nature of his existence, of the absolute truth. Not dependent upon anything for coming into being or for going out of being. That's his nature. And that's what we mean when we say the absolute truth. Yeah.
Actually, the Vishnu, all the other forms, even Vasudeva, Krishna, when you say the Vishnu forms, actually they're all Krishna, so it's actually they're subordinate in one sense. You can see.
Yeah, but you can't think they're not different. You know, if even this is incomprehensible to logic, you have to understand that they're not different. Prabhupada quotes this from, he says, we have to understand this about the absolute truth. Now, when you get to the absolute truth, it's going to be a little bit mind-boggling because he exists in a different way from which conditioned things exist. He exists without the possibility of not existing. We exist with the possibility of not existing. We could be here or we could not be here. That tree could be here, could not be here. You know, he exists without the possibility of not existing. If you think that God just might or might not be, you're not even thinking of God. You're thinking of some conditioned thing that you want to call God. If you understand what is meant by God, by absolute truth, that he exists without the possibility of not existing, then you can understand he's there. That's called the ontological argument for the existence of God. Just a minute, let me answer your question. So he exists in a different way. So part of that is that we understand that he also exists in a variety of forms. Huh? It is stated that the Lord has many forms and incarnations. Advaitam, Achyutam, Anadim, Anantarupam. Right away. Advaitam. Without any duality. But Anantarupam. Endless forms. Although there are many transcendental forms of the Lord, they are still one and the same supreme personality of Godhead. One has to understand this fact with conviction, although it is inconceivable to mundane scholars and empiric philosophers and some devotees. As is stated in the Vedas, Eko Devo Nitya Lila Nurakto, Bhaktavyapi Hridyantaratma, the one supreme personality of Godhead, is eternally engaged in many, many transcendental forms and relationships with his unalloyed devotees. This Vedic version is confirmed in this verse of the Gita, Janma Karma Chame Divyam Evam Yoveri Tattvataha. He who accepts this truth and the strength of the authority of the Vedas and of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and who does not waste time in philosophical speculations, attains the highest perfectional stage of liberation. Well, we're going to waste a little time. Simply by accepting this truth on faith, one can without a doubt attain liberation. Anyone who understands Lord Krishna to be the Supreme, or who says unto Lord Krishna, "You are the same Supreme Brahman, the Personality of Godhead," is certainly liberated instantly. That's what Prabhupada says, right? So we have to understand. Yeah?
In this verse, Om Purnam Adat Purnam Idam, it says that this phenomenal world is all perfect and same, but it's actually not the same than Krishna.
No, it's not. Prabhupada explains in his purport very elaborately in what sense. He says, when you see or understand this material world as part of the absolute whole, then you see how it's complete, when it's dovetailed with the complete. But if you don't experience it as part of the absolute whole independently, then it is incomplete. But actually, it's part of the complete whole. Not that it has independent existence.
But it's not the same like the Vishnutandas, you know, like...
No, it's not the same.
Brahma Samhita, you know what he said? Because this is an energy of Krishna.
That's right. Vishnu Tattvas are not energy. They are not energy. And it's not that Achincha Beta Beta Tattva applies between Krishna and Balaram. They're not Beta Abeta. They're just Abheda. They're one. So, anyway, I want to understand, this is the nature of this independent existence of the Absolute Truth. Exists without the possibility of not existing. If it existed with the possibility of not existing, then it would be... conditioned being, and then you're not talking about the absolute truth. As I said, St. Anselm made up this argument for the existence of God, which is not worth using because it's so controversial. People have spilt a lot of ink on it. But it goes, let's see if I can remember it. He says, he defines God as a being a greater than which cannot be conceived. And he says, now we can think of beings that exist with the possibility of not existing, and we can think of beings without the possibility of not existing. You and I are the kind of beings who have the possibility of not existing. And also, we can also think of something who exists without the possibility of not existing. Now, which is a being or greater than which you can't conceive? Well, it's better to exist without the possibility of not existing, to exist with the possibility of not existing. Without it is greater. So he says, therefore we can understand, he says, that the Supreme Lord is a form of the prayer that you exist so truly that you exist without the possibility of not even not existing. What this says is that people who think that God might or might not exist are not even thinking about God, and that if you understand what God is truly, I mean as absolute truth, then you'll understand that he has to exist. So, I have this similar feeling. Although, as I said, if you use the argument with people, you'll get in a lot of trouble. Logicians go crazy with this one. You know? Yes?
What do you mean by exist? Because Krishna says, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nor all these kings, nor ever will there be a time when any of us shall cease.
That's right.
To be. So that means we always exist.
Yeah, but I assume that we existed with the possibility of not existing. Yes. Like you and I. It's not necessary that we're here. So now you come to the notion that if everything you see in this world is dependent, and you say, where does it come from, or where does it get its power from, or what sustains it, or what upholds it, or what keeps it going? It might not be. And then you say, well, there's another entity which is its cause. And you can say, well, where does that come from? And there's another entity. So you could just keep going on back. This is the, which is an argument that we run across a lot with people. They profess to believe in this. Well, it just keeps going. That's all. It's turtles all the way down, and you know, like that. The infinite regress. Where we say, no, there has to be an absolute truth. There has to be, ultimately, you come to an end. A special, unique being, which is has certain properties that are different, not dependent, the source of everything. So, if we look at this idea of this series, this infinite series, I guess if we accept that we're starting with something that's contingent, that's another philosophical word meaning dependent or conditioned, or it might be, or existence is dependent upon something else. So if its existence is dependent on something else, then you have to give a reason for its existence. What brought it into being? Why is it here? You have to give a reason for it. So when you say, well, there was another being that brought it into being, that's the reason, then you want a reason for that. And you see, on you go, so you get a whole string of them. And you say, well, this string just keeps on going back. But it seems like if you, well, take the whole series, the complete series of this string of contingent beings. Is the whole thing contingent or not? Well, if every part of it is contingent, then the whole thing must be contingent. So you have to say, well, what brings the whole thing into being? Otherwise, why should anything exist at all? Why should it be here? So it seems to me that you got a problem on your hands with this infinite regress. And it ultimately comes down to saying, there's no cause. It's just another way of saying, there's no cause. Infinite regress means, well, we keep looking and looking and we can't find it. We keep going back and we can't find something. Prabhupada had an interview with an Irish poet who said, you know, who brought God into being? My question is, who created God? Yes, God created the world, but who created God? He was raising this point, that God is like one other thing in this world. And if somebody has to create the world, then somebody has to create God. Well, the Vedic seers, they recognized that somebody had to create the gods too. Who is it? So they understood there was one thing, that it wasn't this infinite regress, which doesn't really answer the question. It is a way of not answering the question. Because if you have a whole series, then you say, well, what brought the series into be? If it might not have been, why is it here? Why is it here? If this world might not have been, then there has to be some reason why it's here. If the whole series of things might not have been, there has to be some reason why it's there. Ultimately, what you do is you give up the search for reasons. And you just say, it just is. And then you profess to be happy with that. You give up a belief in causality. And this is basically, as I said before, the kind of Buddhist philosophy. The world is contingent. It's there for no reason whatsoever. And because of that, it's unreal. It's seen as unreal. And no one can give any reason for why it exists or why it's here. And you're just discouraged from inquiring into it. That's what has to happen. There's one thing, is there's these kinds of arguments in favor that you have to come to an absolute truth. There's other things, too. If you have an infinite regress, then you have this notion of something called an infinity. Now, does any such thing exist at all? I mean, you may have some idea like that, but does anybody know that there's an infinity of material things? Just because there's some mathematical conception, you know, that every number has a succeeding number and therefore you can keep on counting until you run out of time. You have to run out of something. So, in mathematics, one mathematician, Cantor, did a whole mathematics of infinity, and it's very controversial because people are not sure whether such a thing exists. Because when you start to get involved with infinite sets, you get to start to have very strange properties. Like, for example, say you have a hotel that has infinite rooms. Hotel Infinity. That has infinite rooms. Now the fact is, and say it's full. Every there's no vacancy. Every room is occupied. And a new guest comes to check in. Even though it says no vacancy, you can still check them in. You can still check them in. Because here's what you do. You have a bellhop goes out, down to infinite bellhops down the hall, and they blow a whistle. All the doors open. The guy in room one goes to room two. The guy in room two goes to room three. The guy in room three goes to room four. The guy, and so on, all the way back. And the new guy goes into room one. So the way the reasoning goes for this thing is you can then say you got 10 guests, 15 guests, 100 guests, 1,000 guests, infinite guests. So here you get this idea. And then, you know, say a bunch of them check out. And still the hotel remains full by the same process. They all check out and it's still full. So here you get this. 1 minus 1 equals 1, 1 plus 1 equals 1. That's described in the invocation of the Isha Upanishad, which applies not to anything in the material world, like a hotel like this, but actually applies to the absolute truth, which has a different kind of existence.
How is it still full?
Huh?
How is it still full?
How does one?
How is it still full when they check out?
Same problem. Talk to me after class, okay? It's not my theory anyway, you know. That's the way it works. There's a whole... Buddha Yoga, he studied this stuff. He's a mathematician. He has a PhD in mathematics. Go see him. If you think I can confuse you, he can really confuse you. Yeah?
Would it be possible then, or is it correct to say that except for receiving descending knowledge, revealed knowledge about the absolute, one will continue on that infinite regress?
Well, no, you may know people don't do that, because people who are speculative come to the notion of an absolute truth also. You can say that some people come to that idea by speculative reasoning, not by revelation, so far as we know. Although when they do that, they tend to do it in a certain spiritual context, like Plato, for example. You know, there's a notion in Plato, or even before Plato, what's his name? Parmenides. The One. You know, the Greek philosophers knew about this One, which was the source of everything and so on. It was already there, and so far as we can see, there it was arrived at through speculative knowledge. So you might hit upon it. But we have to say that there are other speculators who don't want to get there and want to profess to be perfectly at home in the idea, really, of what it amounts to, no cause. That's what the infinite read, there's no cause, and I'm perfectly happy with it. And you can say that. And Prabhupada would just at that point say, you know, I want to talk to reasonable men. You know, they said that Prabhupada once said, somebody said, well, a scientist would say, and Prabhupada, scientist, I'm talking about reasonable people. So to me, it's irrational. This infinite regress or no cause is just irrational. But somebody, what can you say? No causes.
I'm talking about
Ramakrishna.
You said that somebody can attend that stage.
Well, they realize that there is a one source of everything. Sure.
Which is
Brahman.
Brahman. Yeah. Brahman or Brahman?
Brahman. Yeah, they get that far. Well, they don't usually tend to get any farther by this, by speculation. Then they have to go. Now, the other thing is, and this is the other thing you can take into account, is not just rational and reason, but people's experience. People do have spiritual experience. And here, all over the world, at least you get a testimony by a certain kind of people who follow a certain, what Prabhupada calls in the purport, spiritual technology. The editors left it out, but he calls it, he means techniques, spiritual techniques of freeing oneself. And Plato talks about rising to the absolute truth, and to do that you have to become free from material desire. Same thing in the Taoist texts. You know, if you want to see the unity, you have to become free from desire. All over the place, this is there. So if you actually want to experience this, you know, one source of everything, then there's certain things you have to do to be fit to encounter it. So there's also that level of spiritual experience. People have encountered this absolute truth. And that's what, this is what we get from the Vedas. Not only do we have revealed scriptures of Krishna speaking himself, but we also have the experience of people who have attained Krishna consciousness by direct perception. So there's that too, in addition to whatever reason and logic we can answer. We don't really depend upon reason and logic. We accept the authority of Shastra. But because we meet so many people who put forward opposing arguments against the principles of Krishna consciousness, then we have to be prepared to deal with them on their terms. But there's problems with reason and logic. Even if all your reasoning is completely valid, they can reject a premise. You know, do you know how a valid argument, has a premise and a conclusion. I'm talking about a deductive argument. A deductive argument has premises and conclusions. And if it's valid, if it's correct, then if the premises are true, notice this if the premises are true, then it is sure and certain that the conclusion is true. So here's a deductive argument form. All men are mortal. Akhiladhara is a man. Therefore, Akhiladhara is mortal. See? That is a valid argument. Nothing wrong with it. It's completely solid. So he finds out from this argument, all men are mortal. I'm a man, therefore I'm mortal. He doesn't like the conclusion. Makes him nervous. So what does he say? He says, how do you know all men are mortal? So he rejects one of the premises. How do you know all men are mortal? You don't know that. Who? How many men have you seen? How do you know that I might be the exception? I feel different. I've had this. I heard it. Someone told me they were convinced that they were different. And maybe he rejects the other one. How do you know I'm a man? Maybe I descended on this planet. Yeah. So anybody who wants to, any argument, you look at the premises, and if you don't like the conclusion, then you can deny at least one of the premises. So what a valid argument really does is show you the price you have to pay to deny the conclusion. That's the best you can do with an argument that's valid. That's why you have to say, you know, you're talking about reasonable people. So if somebody, you know, will not accept the premise that, you know, you cannot give what you haven't got, or that every event has to have a cause, simple things like that, what can you do? There's not that much you can do. Except put him in for psychoanalysis or something. Give him prasadam, you know, take him to a mental hospital. I mean, people try to function on those kinds of things, it won't work. You know, like Like, you know, if they come home and find their house on fire, they wonder who did it. You say, it just happened, no cause. You know, everybody's going around looking for an arsonist, looking for a cause. He doesn't want the fire to break out. No, no, it just happened, no cause. That's it, no. Take your philosophy. It happened without a cause. Go ahead, actually work on it. They don't. They don't work on it. So you can argue, you know, in various ways, but if people really hate it, you know, they hate God. They don't want to be an absolute truth. They're going to find some way to avoid the fact. Yeah.
If Vishnu Tattva as a whole is eternal, what does it exactly mean that Krishna is the original or the everyone else?
Yeah, it's not the Krishna's originality is not a temporal originality. Our dependence on Krishna is not a temporal dependence, but an ontological dependence. Now, ont just means in being. You know, I mean, the example Prabhupada gives of this is that of the sun and the sunshine. Of course, in the material world, there's also a temporal thing. But he says the sun is the source and the sunshine is the product. They both are there simultaneously, but one is independent and the other is dependent. So the idea is that even though we're eternal and we exist along with Krishna, and it wasn't that Krishna was there first and we were there second, still we're dependent and he's independent. Yeah.
But I was considering in terms of Vishnu Tattva, like in terms of Lord Ramachandra, or the different Vishnu Tattva, what does it mean to say that Krishna is actually the original?
Oh, Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam. That he's more complete. That he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. Just like Lord Govinda Maharaj is using the expression Purna. He's complete in Dwarka, more complete in Mathura, and most complete in Vrindavan. Purna. So the analysis is given of Krishna as opposed to the Vishnu Tattvas, that with Krishna, he has certain features the others don't have, and that all the rasas are exhibited in relationship with Krishna, where they're only partially exhibited in relationship with others. So that for these reasons, he's considered to be the original. Bhagavan Swayam, original self, and that the others are his expansions, and he's the source of all expansions.
So that's yeah. Those two with the mood?
With what?
Basically with the relationship between him and the
mood. Yeah, and also more intimate, which is higher.
Yeah,
the original candle and other candles. But again, you see, that's like has a temporal connotation to it. He wants to know whether if you don't have that. So it's very hard for us to think about non-temporal succession. non-temporal sequence. But in essence, that's what you have, is like a non-temporal sequence. And, or a hierarchy, or like that. And it's you know, some things you won't understand with 64 ounces, huh?
When we say Krishna Swayam, Krishna appear, is himself, is God himself.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't say the same thing like with Ramachandra. Is the Ramachandra happening also by himself, or is going through that?
No, he is one of the members of the Chaturvyuha. Yeah, yeah, right. When it says, Ete Chamsa Kalapum Sam Krishnas Tu Bhagavan Swayam. All these are expansions or expansions of expansions, but Krishna is Bhagavan Swayam. In other words, he's not an expansion.
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is not an expansion.
No. Well, I'm talking about Krishna right now. Krishna, this is about Krishna. Then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna himself in the mood and position of complexion of Radharani.
And Ramachandra?
Ramachandra is an incarnation of there's Pradyumna, Sankarshan, Aniruddha, and Vasudeva. He's Vasudeva. He's Vasudeva. And then he has three brothers, who are the other three of the Chaturvyuha, which is the first quadruple expansion. There's Krishna, and then he expands himself into Balaram, who is also known as Shankarshan. There's a Shankarshan expansion. Then there's Chaturvyuha. And then I think there's a second Chaturvyuha. I'm not sure. Yeah. So this way they expand like that. How do people know this? It has to be the spiritual experience and revelation. A lot of revelation is people's spiritual experience. Just like, for example, Brahma Samhita. In one sense, it's revelation. It's Krishna giving, but it's Brahma's experience. His testimony of his experience that he saw Krishna, and he reports, you know, Chintamani Prakara Sadmasu, this is what I saw. You know, so a lot of revelation is people's experience. Just like even Bhagavad Gita is the experience of Vyasadeva, who's Krishna himself, but still that's what it is. So it's people's report. It's called Vaidusha Pratyaksha in Jiva Goswami. Pratyaksha means direct experience of Vaidusha, not anybody, but those who are liberated souls, the wise. That's their testimony. You can believe almost everything on testimony. You know, most people in the world today believe there's a war going on in what used to be Yugoslavia. You know, testimony, because it says so on the evening news. You know, most people believe there's such a country called China. Very few have been there, but they all are absolutely convinced of this fact by testimony. Shabda, by hearing, by testimony. But whose testimony? Well, ultimately, we want the testimony of perfect people. Yeah.
When you see this, when you hear about this Chaturvyuha, so it seems that then there is a beginning in this process of being Vaikuntha. Like, there is Krishna first, then at one point, Krishna becomes Balaram.
No, doesn't work like that. There's some place you can see a temporal succession begins when you get Mahavishnu and Garbhodakshaya Vishnu and Shiro. You get the Purusha avatars. When you get avatars, then you have succession. But the others are all eternal. They're all eternal. Get it? Says it comes from Krishna. Every notion that we have of coming from in this material world, I try to think of some examples to try to make this clear, but there's a notion of dependence and succession that is not dependent on, and yet they've all always been there and have always been eternal, of at least subordination. This is very hard to think about. The one example that Prabhupada gave was in relationship to Krishna and the jivas, how can the jivas be dependent if they're eternal? And he says, like the sun and the sunshine, one is dependent, but both are there simultaneously. So we don't really have to, you know, have a firm grasp on all these things until we are completely free from the modes of material nature. Then it'll become a little clearer. Yeah, Purcell?
You said the infinite regress theory was irrational,
mm-hmm.
and you because it gave up causality, but doesn't accepting an absolute truth also have some irrationality and also give up causality? Because you're saying that the absolute
mm-hmm.
truth
has no cause. Yeah, but at least I'm saying that here it's more rational to say that somewhere there has to be an end to causality. So where have I put it? You see, what they do when they get the infinite regress series is really, you know, try to give the material world some attributes of the absolute truth, that it's self-causing. So we say, no, self-causing belongs to a unique, particular kind of being. The absolute truth is self-born, self-causing, self-sufficient, self-manifesting. He's the cause of his own self. So that's, we say that this is a particular being that has unique properties. Quite unique properties. And we want to discuss that being. And everything else is dependent. Now what you want to do is you want to take, in essence, the material world you see around it and sneak in some of these unique qualities and mix them up with other qualities, which, and so the whole thing doesn't seem to belong together. So the right place, Anadir Adir Govinda, he has no origin. Anadir Adi, but he is the origin of everything. That's the beginning of Brahma Samhita. Ishwara Parama Krishna Sat Chit Ananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda. He has no cause, but he is the supreme cause, but he is, Anadir means he has no origin. He has no origin, but is the origin of all else. Sarva Karana Karanam, and of all causes, he is the supreme or the final cause. So you may say that being is not understandable by us. That's quite true. A very unique kind of a being. It seems to me that that's better to, at least from a rational point of view, that belongs to this kind of unique being than to the material world itself. And we understand that if something that exists that's independent is going to be different from everything else. It's going to give and give and give from everything whom everything emanates, and yet he himself is not dependent upon anything else. His existence is really different. So if you understand that how different he is, and then you understand that that absolute truth is Krishna. The Krishna is not one of us who just happened to be in that position. That's the supreme personality of Godhead. Whenever we're envious of Krishna, otherwise he wouldn't be in the material world. And we're envious of Krishna because he thinks he's one of us that just happened to make it. We're putting him on our same level to be envious. If we understand that he is categorically different, and that as the source of everything, he is, in a sense, everything. We can't compete with him. So he just doesn't happen to be God. He doesn't happen to be the absolute truth. He's the supreme personality of Godhead. That's who he is. He's in a class by himself, Nitya. And somehow or other, you see, there's this eternal class division in transcendence. In the material world, nobody likes class division. The lower classes are in revolt eternally against the upper classes, and the upper classes are holding down the ambition of the lower classes. Nobody wants class divisions, right? This comes from the fact that in the material world, we're like the original settlers of Australia, you know? We've all been transported from the spiritual world here. We're convict ships have come down here. So we got hostilities. Anyway, we have to accept this division. That here's one category, the category of the master, there's only one, that's Krishna. And here's the other category, that's the category of the servant. Here we are. And we can't cross over. Because he exists in a way quite differently from the way that we exist. We got to give up this notion of becoming God. We have to accept the fact that we belong in this category. We're not the one, we're the many. Yeah.
Is there also some sampradaya so they accept Narayan as the supreme personality of Godhead? But this video also in Srimad Bhagavatam, where he said, Nidhi Santrakala, Krishna. Still, they do not accept Krishna as the ultimate source of all.
They also accept. Oh, you mean that of... No, they will... Different ones, they have different opinions. Yeah, sure.
But they would say that Krishna is an avatar.
Ramanuja did not make any reference to the Srimad Bhagavatam. As the Ramanujas worshipped Narayan. Didn't worship Krishna. Neither did they worship Ram, Sita Ram. It was only later, there's the Ramanadis... the followers of Ramananda, who was in the Ramanuja Sampradaya, that they begin to worship Sita Ram. Nor Madhva. Nimbarka, they worshipped Radha and Krishna.
They would be considered bona fide.
And also Vallabhas. So two of the Sampradayas worship Radha Krishna like that. Madhva Sampradaya, no. They worship Narayan with Lakshmi, Boo, and Leela, his energies.
Nimbarka, they accept Lord Chaitanya?
No, Nimbarka's before, was before Lord Chaitanya. But Nimbarka, that's also their deity is Radha and Krishna. That's the worship in the mood of the gopis. That's something else again.
Oh, so just Radha Krishna, the Nimbarka.
Yeah, they, all I know is that at least according to OBL Kapoor, their deities are Radha and Krishna, because Nimbarka lived in Vrindavan. So the different, the different sampradayas, some of them are on different levels of realization, or their acharyas only revealed so much. So that verse is there, Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam. It's one verse. Jiva Goswami argues that it's what's called a Mahavakya, a great saying. There's certain attributes that a statement has to have in order to be a Mahavakya, and the Mahavakya means is one in light of which all other utterances are read or understood. It has a special significance. So it's one verse there in the Srimad Bhagavatam.
Just like the Sankacharya fathers will have Mahavakya.
They have their Mahavakyas, yeah. They say Tattvamasi is a Mahavakya. And Lord Chaitanya argues, no, the Omkara is the Mahavakya. That's not, right.
But then the other Sampradayas will say that there are other Mahavakyas.
Maybe.
Like Ramanuja.
Yeah, well, I don't know what Ramanuja says about that. But we don't accept that the differences among the Vaishnavas are all that significant. I mean, Lord Chaitanya didn't make a big deal of it. He criticized the Tattvavadis he visited after discussing with them what is the ultimate goal. And they said attainment of Vaikuntha. And he looked at their deity worship, asked them how you did it, how you attained it, and he said you're contaminated by karma and gyan. There's some tinge of that there. He saw it in them. That's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, his critique of them. So they all. What our understanding is that each one of the four Vaishnava Acharyas contributed something toward the establishment of actual Krishna consciousness, but that. In the Lord Chaitanya's, the Chincha Beta Beta Tattva, they are summed up and unified and completed, that they are not all complete, so they have some limitations here and there. But if you're going to be put off by the fact that there happens to be mere differences of opinion, you're going to have a hard time.
the other two sampradayas, one can't go beyond Dasyaras, is that it?
I can't say about all the sampradayas. It's true about, for example, relationship with. Not true about Balabhacharya. Yeah, they worship Bal Krishna, and that's Vatsalya Rasa. But in where Narayan is worshipped, or Ramchandra, then there's Dasya Rasa.
Balabhacharya isn't one of the four sampradayas.
He says to come from Vishnuswami. Vishnuswami is the original of that. And Balabhacharya later, who's a contemporary of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
He's like a branch of the Vishnuswami.
Yeah, they trace themselves back to Vishnu Swami, who's, I don't think his writings are still around. Now it's time to stop for lunch. Okay.